Hello and welcome to Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, and I'm here with you every week to answer questions large and small. But today we're taking a little departure. Today we're going to explore a rather unique lifestyle. You are listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington, your island connection. My guest today is Cam Sigler, and what's unique about Cam is so many things. He is a global fishing and hunting expert, and that gives him a lifestyle that many of us might envy. Welcome, Cam.
Thank you.
It's a delight to have you here, and I really appreciate your taking the time. You are a Vashon Islander, but how much time do you actually spend on the island?
Over the last 15 years, not a whole lot. just traveling pretty much all over the Pacific Rim, whether it be business for developing and designing product, or now it's more just, for the most part, a fishing-related endeavor.
Tell us a little more about that. When you say fishing-related endeavor, what exactly is that?
So I travel on a number of different levels, fishing around, like I would say, the Pacific Rim for the most part, but also parts of Europe. And I host trips. I run a fly fishing business in Seattle also now. I basically supply more flies, and my father and I started this business many years ago for catching sailfish and marlin on fly rods than anybody else in the world does. So not only hosting trips, doing conservation types of things, working and being asked by certain governments to come into areas to take a look at their resources and how to better manage those. So I do a little bit of all of that.
So tell us something about, say, the most recent government you worked with on resources.
So most recently I was in Mongolia. That would have been in July. And so we were in doing programs on the initial part of the trip on tagging taimen, which is the largest trout on the planet.
How big are they?
The biggest one on record would have been from, I think, the 40s, and it was a little over 6 feet 11 inches and over, 200 and something pounds.
That's like a shark.
Yes, and they're a predatory fish, as it were. But, we were going in and doing tagging, fin clipping, and scale samples to find out how big these fish are, how old they are, what the sex would be, what their lifespan is. You know, we get reports which are not, we're not sure how accurate they are, that some of these fish live to be 30 or 40 years old. We'll hopefully, when we get the research back, as we sent scale samples and fin clips to different places in the U.S. and we're just waiting on that feedback back. But hopefully with the Mongolian government and their parks department, we can go back and say, this is what we think you need to do. This is how you need to protect this resource, because it's fairly untapped.
So you are an expert in fishing, consuming fish, and in hunting.
Yeah, and it's not so much the consumption as it is just to go in and look at the resource, bring people from all places all over the world, and to go in to enjoy not so much the fishing or the hunting, but the environment in itself. So, you know, you look at it from a standpoint where, yeah, you come in and you get to catch the fish of a lifetime, but you also understand from that end all the other resources that are around it, all the other parts of nature, whether it be the animals or other fish. Just like in the first place we went in Mongolia, in the Tangashishgad watershed, there is a golden-tailed grayling, which appears nowhere else on the planet. Now, why that genetic developed, we still don't know. But we're catching golden-tailed grayling, taimen, and lennock, which lennock is the oldest species of trout known to man. So, you know, I just lucky enough to do what I love and get, and, you know.
How does a person get to be a hunting and fishing expert? Where did that start for you?
So it started, moved to Vashon. My father took a job with Eddie Bauer, which was just an outdoor company at that time in 1968. Mm-hmm. I think we actually moved here in late 67, and he was with him for 18 years. So I basically grew up in that industry. And then, you know, through some other deviations on doing things, that kind of got me started. So, you know, still to the point now where I worked at Eddie Bauer in the, would have been the early 90s or early to mid 90s running the fly shop there. My father had left there at that point, but was as a consultant. Did that for a few years and then went to work with him. And we did international business on design, development, product sourcing for many years.
What kind of products?
Primary product would be high-tech fishing waders. But we did footwear, luggage, the whole bit. I'm still involved to a certain extent consulting for some of the bigger parts of the industry and the high-tech breathable fishing wader business. So that's kind of how I got my start. But, you know, just luckily, I've been able to travel the world and do what I love.
So tell us about your most exciting global fishing or hunting expedition, and what was it that made it exciting?
You know, I get asked that a lot. Where was your favorite place to go? What was your biggest experience? And so I can't really quantify that by saying it was one certain place. The biggest thing I can say is that the people make the biggest difference, whether or not I'm fishing or hunting. And I probably have to go to the most recent. So I was just came out of South Africa a couple of weeks ago. And that was doing photo safaris and a little bit of hunting. But, you know, starting to get into that realm, Mongolia in July. But, you know, I've had crazy experiences where I've caught things and just experienced people in Fiji, Australia, Guatemala, Costa Rica, Mexico. I can't really put one above the other.
How much danger is there involved in what you do?
On the fishing end, I don't think it's so much other than just the environments that you're in, as far as just being in nature. I just recently came back from Africa and hunted a Cape buffalo, which is considered to be one of the most dangerous things to do. But then again, when I guided in Alaska in the late 80s, you know, I had to deal with brown bears on a daily basis. So probably dealing with the bears is the most dangerous, but unfortunately, just because of the environment, I had to deal with people that were probably more dangerous than the bears.
Do you have a story or two that you could tell us about people and bears? Or
Just put it this way. I was guiding four dairy farmers from the Midwest in Alaska at one point, and somebody mentioned something, and I turned around, and the guy that was managing the lodge was down on the ground, and someone had a gun stuck in his face.
Oh.
So luckily we got through that whole situation where nobody got hurt. But when somebody has a semi-automatic stuck in someone that you're working with's mouth, basically, it's a little bit trying.
What did he do to earn that treat?
Well, caveat to that was that they said that they were commercial fishing, and they had closed the season, and they saw airplanes on the beach, and they came to run the fish and wildlife off because they closed the season. But unfortunately, they had decided to drink a little bit from a dry town down the beach. And when it came down to it, I was the only one that positive identified all three guys, and they all went to federal prison for a number of years. So that was probably the scariest part that type of thing.
You didn't send the people you were guiding to prison. It was the people who attacked.
Unfortunately, there was three natives, and they were the ones that showed up with guns. And yes, they all went to federal prison.
Did they think you were somehow violating the law or violating their space?
The village elders, unfortunately, at that point, and I found out from the state troopers, basically put something in the paper, and they marked me for the next couple of years. So after that season, I left Alaska for a while.
So is your face up on a poster in Alaska somewhere?
No, but there was articles written in that local paper where basically they were supposed to get rid of me. So
wow.
Because I was the only one that identified him out of eight people.
Oh, so, I see.
Yeah.
I see. So, wow. Anything like that happening in any of the other countries? Like, what was your experience in Costa Rica?
You know, I have never had a situation anywhere near to that end on any of the countries that I've been in. And, you know, I look typically if I'm going, especially to a new country, I look, you know, through the State Department, that type of thing, to see if there's any flags raised. Typically, there's not. But my point to traveling all over the planet would be to tell people, if you're going to travel, look at it. And if you're in a bad place in a country that's foreign, you can still be in a bad place here. So trying to stay out of certain areas, what we would say red areas, I mean, you can be in a bad place in Seattle. So that's your biggest concern is just stay out of those areas.
So you've been to some South American countries and Central American countries, and I'm thinking particularly of Colombia, which is considered somewhat dangerous.
So if you look right now, and if you look at the statistics, I was in Colombia in, I think it was May this year. Mm-hmm. Bogota and that type of thing, you're fine to walk around. I mean, you don't want to wear all your jewelry and that type of thing, but that's anywhere on the planet.
Right.
But right now, as far as I know, as if I remember, I haven't looked in a few months, but the most dangerous place in Central America is Guatemala City.
Ah.
And I'm in Guatemala a lot. I've been there three times since last November because I fish there quite a bit. It's the most productive sailfish grounds in the world, and so that's why I'm there. But when I get to the city, I immediately go to the airport and I leave and I go to Antigua or I go to the coast. So Bogota actually is not considered to be one of the most dangerous places. It's Guatemala City.
Interesting. When you're in those cities, have you ever observed any sort of violence going on?
Yeah, at times you see it, but it's typically as you're in a vehicle and, you know, just like going anywhere, you try and get established with someone that's from there. And it's their job or kind of bringing you in to kind of keep you, you know, away from areas which would be, we'd say, high crime, that type of thing.
If someone came to you and said they wanted to catch the biggest fish ever, but they didn't know where to go, what would you advise to them and where would you take them?
So I tell a lot of people this all the time. If you're going to go somewhere, let me know who the outfitter is, what you want to catch. And if I haven't been there, I probably through my network know where to go. So it's more relative to what type of fish do you want to catch? Do you want to catch a big tuna? Do you want to catch a big billfish? Do you want to catch a marlin? Do you want to catch the biggest peacock bass in the world? I know where
What's
to go.
What's a peacock bass?
So a peacock bass is not a true bass. It's a cichlid, which is more like an Oscar you'd see in a fish tank.
Uh-huh.
But they grow, the Asu phase grows to 25 pounds. I'll be back in Brazil probably this February chasing very, very large peacock bass. And so it's a fish that's a freshwater fish. We try and go to the blackwater areas of the Amazon, which the blackwater is water that has a lot of leaves in it. It's more tannin. The mosquitoes can't breed. So malaria or just getting bit by mosquitoes is very rare, if not non-existent. Makes it a lot more comfortable. So if you want to catch a peacock, I'm going to take you to Brazil.
You are listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. I am Susan McCabe. The show is Real Talk, and we can do this thanks to the generosity of Windermere Vashon Real Estate. They make all our community information programming possible, and our emergency alert service as well. We're talking with Cam Sigler, who is a global fishing and hunting expert. I'm sure that you have a lifestyle that most people would envy. What can you describe what a day for you is like when you're on the job?
So yeah, I can. So it And yes, it sounds very
very romantic, yes. Very adventurous.
Yes. But then again, you know, I spent my life doing this, and it is a job. So when I get up in the morning, let's say I'm hosting a trip and I'm taking someone. I get up in the morning, I make sure that the staff at wherever we're staying has everything that everyone needs. If there's any medical issues or dietary issues, I make sure that's taken care of. I go down, I make sure that they have everything on the boat that they need for the day, whether that be down to, you know, drinks or water or coffee. But, you know, all the fly rods are set up. All the reels are set up. Even though I have a captain and two mates, I'm still standing right behind the angler to make sure that they're more successful. So it sounds a little bit, I don't know how you put it, but that's my job, whether or not that, or let's say I'm running dogs. So I'm taking someone out to go hunting and I'm in charge of all the dogs. So, you know, whether it be I'm running two dogs or six, that's my job.
Where do you get the dogs when you're out of the country?
Well, I train the dogs typically, or if I have other dogs that are with other people that are with me, I'll also run those, because I've spent so much time in the outdoors. It's not about harvesting the bird or this. It's the experience that the people around me have. So, you know, as far as the dog running goes, I mean, I've got my own, but I'm just there to make sure that everybody has the best experience.
Do you ship your dogs overseas, or do you?
I don't ship them overseas so much, just because of the issues we have with that. But like Eddie, the Bauer dog, I mean, he's been all over the country. You know, to ship dogs overseas, you can do it, but you have quarantines and that type of thing.
Right.
It's hard on the dog. So, you know, I'm much better off to go somewhere. I mean, I have opportunity right now in Argentina where somebody may bring me down to train some dogs that they have there. So if I do go back to Argentina, I have dogs that I've trained that I can work.
So let's go to the dog training part. If you go to Argentina, how much time do you have to spend training a couple of dogs for hunting?
So typically it would be starting a dog at 6 months, because you want them socialized to family and little kids and all that good stuff. There's a whole thing to that. But if I get a dog that has some pretty good attributes at 6 months and has good breeding, in 2 months you can make a working dog. But if you really want a dog that really knows what it's doing, that's years.
Wow. So tell us the difference between a working dog and a hunting dog that really knows what it's doing.
So a working dog would be, or I say working dog, that's a dog that has basic discipline, where it's going to come to heel, it's going to listen, it's going to take some commands. Where you get to a dog that really knows what it's doing, one, the dog has to have some ability, because we do, just like when I went to Bauer in 2009, the CEO said, I want a field trial champion again. Well, I said, okay, we're going to buy six puppies, and at 6 months, we're going to weed out down to two. And then we might have a dog, then in a couple of years, we'll elevate to where it actually could win some titles, do that type of thing. So it's a process, and each dog, just like people, have different personalities. I have six dogs at home. Mm-hmm. Each dog has a different personality. I have to deal with each dog for the most part on a little bit different level. So to really get a really good working dog and know what they're doing, for instance, Eddie and his half brother Bass, I train them, and it doesn't take a lot of time. I mean, it can 20 minutes a day, but I train them for over 3 years, 6 days a week.
And they now, are hunting dogs?
And they are hunting dogs, but they're also just good family dogs. You know, they won't growl. I mean, you might get one to look at the other one sideways, playing with a toy or something, yeah. but it takes a lot of time, and you also have to find, you know, breeding does make a difference.
What
you
is
know,
the best breed?
I don't know. It depends on the person. You know, I've grown up with labs. And I still have labs, but I have three labs, a Catahoula hound, a beagle, and a miniature dachshund. So,
are they all hunters?
Yes. The dachshund's not formally trained, but he will, yes, if there's something around the house, more than likely he's going to look for it. So it's a lot of fun. I'm just, you know, I'm very fortunate.
It sounds like a lot of fun. You get to live the life that you dreamed of. Let's go to that. Okay. When you were a kid, did you dream of doing things like this?
You know, I don't know if it was so much of a dream. You know, I was raised here, so certain avenues, you know, weren't really available, only because of, even though you're near a big city, just with the ferries and the whole bit. I mean, I had my father, a couple of the guys that worked with my father at Eddie Bauer and for him, were on the U.S. national ski team, and they were Olympic athletes. And so they wanted to take me at one point and said, we'll take him and we can make him, you know, a world-class shooter, but I just didn't have the capacity to go off island because of just logistics.
Wait, they were on the ski team, but they wanted to teach you to shoot?
Yes. So they were on the Olympic ski team, U.S. Olympic ski team.
Is that the biathlon where they
this is
shoot?
Skeet. No. So biathlon is where you're doing skiing and shooting with a rifle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, skeet was just at the time, it's just, that's where you have houses where clay pigeons come out and they cross.
Skeet. I thought you said ski.
No, I'm sorry. Skeet.
Skeet. Okay.
So
now
shoot, shotgun shoot.
Sorry, listeners.
No, shotgun
You probably
shoot.
Heard that before I did. But so you, but you didn't become a sharpshooter.
No, because it, logistically it wasn't viable at the time to go over and do that. I mean, same thing. I grew up playing soccer here on Vashon and played through high school and the whole bit. And I just didn't have the capacity to get to Seattle on a daily basis to get to a level that, you know, wanted to get to. So on the outdoor end, I guess subconsciously, I always knew that I'd probably end up in the outdoor business, and I deviated some over the years, but that's what always brought me back to just, I mean, I love doing it. It's just, it's in my nature.
Are you a sole proprietor entrepreneur at this point?
Yes, in a couple different businesses, but I also am partnered in a business in Seattle also.
So for the most part, your schedule and your life are under your control.
Completely.
That's unusual. Not a lot of people get
that. Yeah, and it's there's rewards to it, but also a lot of risk. Because
sure.
Unless I generate funds, whether I'm consulting for a major company in the U.S. or trying to partner with, I mean, I've got opportunities in South Africa now and Mongolia, that type of thing. But yeah, I don't know. I've been doing it so long now. I guess I'm just used to it.
And you probably can't afford to say no very often.
No, I say no quite often, which might be surprising, but
yeah.
There's a lot of opportunities that are presented where I just say no. And that's only because of just having, I guess, those opportunities for many years. And I've made a lot of bad choices on businesses. But then again, you know, the learning curve, you get better at it the older you get.
Failure is a teacher.
Yes. Sometimes, and sometimes the lessons are hard, whether it be financially or mentally. That just happens.
Right.
So that's just the way it works.
So Cam Sigler, I bet your passport is loaded.
Yes, and they won't let me add extra pages anymore. I have to get a new one every few years. So, yes, it's got a lot of stamps in it.
So where is your next trip, and what will it be?
I'm running to Alaska in a couple weeks.
Oh, so you're
weeks.
Going back to Alaska?
Yeah, I've been back since then and stuff. I'm going to Alaska in a couple weeks. I turned down going back to Mongolia. I would be there next week if I was going, but I'll be back in the spring. I'll be in Guatemala probably in January, Brazil next February. And then, I don't know. I mean, this year's been a little bit overwhelming just because I've been in 8 countries since last November, in Guatemala, I think 3 times out of those, you know, that's counting as one. So
how do you manage jet lag?
I guess it's just from traveling so much for so many years. You know, I used to go to Cambodia a lot, and that was 30 hours return trip, which South Africa is about that just because of the flights. I try and eat on the same schedule and move my eating schedule a little bit, which I think makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, somebody gave me the accolade when I was in South Africa that, you know, I've got a ton of energy and it didn't really affect me, but I think it's just from doing it so much.
Do you have a particular fitness regimen that you practice?
Yeah, I run dogs every morning and every evening. But
run
no.
dogs, meaning them run or you run with them?
I'm doing both. So, yeah, so there's no real fitness regimen, but, you know, trying to eat healthy and stay healthy, I think that's probably the biggest thing. And, you know, like, you know, for 4 or 5 years of my life, I was, or not for, for most of my life, you know, I'm in better shape in the winter than I am in the summer, only because I'm following dogs through the mountains and I'm hunting here, hunting there, and doing that. So it's just more of a lifestyle.
That's the question. It is a lifestyle that,
yeah,
that
just,
I think,
you know,
that I find fascinating, and I hope our listeners do as well. Two questions. One, and they're totally unrelated in a way. One is about fishing in the Amazon in the dark water. Of course, we all know the Amazon jungle is burning as we speak.
Yes.
What do you know about that, and how does that affect what you're going to be doing down there?
So looking at it from what's happened recently and looking at it, it's a very, very interesting environment that it's got a lot of different factors to it. I mean, if you look at what happened with the pink dolphins years within the last 5 years, because, you know, not only am I down there fishing and hunting, but looking at the environmental end. So they stopped that type of thing. Right now, with the fires burning, part of the problem, I believe, at least in my estimation, is that I'm not sure that the guy running the country, you know, he doesn't necessarily want help and stuff, which makes no sense. But if you look, there's a major road running right now, as I believe, north and south through the Amazon. What they're trying to do and what I think is happening is they're going to try and put a major road east and west. What they're kind of going into what sharecroppers did or whatever, which happened here, I think, in the 20s possibly. So if you go in and establish a residence off of one of these major roads and you take out the timber, which they're going to sell, and you start cattle on it, if you do it within a couple of years, you get grandfathered in where they just hand you that land. That, I think, is the biggest threat to the Amazon. I think part of the reason you have all the fires burning right now is that they've already started to establish, people are establishing residents around. They're starting the fires after they take the timber out to burn it so that they can put cattle on it or that type of thing, and then they'll end up with that. So
once again, it's greed.
Don't quote me on that, but yeah. I think that's kind of part of the issue we're having. And is it going to affect? Yes, it's going to affect what I do because I can't go to a place and take a group of people to see the environment. You know,
when it's burning.
I went north of Manaus 2 years ago, and I have pictures of a jaguar in the wild from 30 feet that had never seen another person. And he's looking at us, I don't know if he's thinking maybe he can jump far enough into the boat to eat us or what. But, you know, you have a 200-pound wild cat. That trip itself, the fishing, we caught 15 different species of fish in the Amazon. But that was more, I mean, at night we'd go on walks, you know, through the forest with our guide, and it was just fascinating. You come around a corner and 30 macaws would blow out of the trees. Oh. You know, you'd wake up to howler monkeys in the morning. At night, you wouldn't get down too close to the river because you had caiman that were, you know, 14 feet long. So
how do you think the current situation is going to affect the potential for those kinds of experiences?
I think in a lot of the places around the world that I've traveled, it's unfortunately going to go away.
That's heartbreaking. And we have run out of time. The last question I had, though, can you tell us the story of your Eddie Bauer dog in 30 seconds?
So when I was hired back at Eddie Bauer in 2009, the CEO, Neil, said we wanted a dog to be a field trial champion. I said, we're never going to see the dog. What do you want to do? So we used him in media. So Eddie now would be March 10th of next year, will be 10 years old. He is still hunting. He's getting a little gray. He's still going 100 miles an hour, which is great. And he belongs completely to me now. And Bauer doesn't use him anymore, but that's all good.
He's the Eddie Bauer dog.
He is the Eddie Bauer dog.
Cam Sigler, I can't thank you enough for joining us here. What a fascinating life you have and some great stories. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, listeners, for listening to Real Talk. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, here with you every week on Tuesday at lunchtime.